Hey there! If you like true crime stories and you love being in the great outdoors, you have come to the right place. I'm Tara, your host. Welcome to Crime Off the Grid. Welcome to another episode of Crime Off the Grid. And a couple of episodes back, we had Ranger Russ here and we talked about antler poaching in the national parks, and that seemed like an actually good introduction to what we're going to hear about today. So joining me is Ranger Dan, who is going to share a case that he investigated, and it's another resource crime. Ranger Dan has 25 years with the National Park Service, and all of his career he was in law enforcement. So Dan started his ranger career in Yellowstone National Park, and then from there he went to Denali National Park, Gulf Islands National Seashore, back to Yellowstone, and then he goes down to Mesa Verde National Park. He works in Grand Canyon National Park, and again, back to Yellowstone, where he retired. And I'm detecting a theme here. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. So welcome, Dan. Thank you very much for joining us and sharing your case with us today.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
All right. Well, did I miss anything on your bio there?
No. I would just maybe qualify it with that most of my time was in Yellowstone. And I did spend 17 winters in Yellowstone is pretty much all I've kept track of on how many years I was anywhere.
Yeah.
That's like a claim to fame, you know.
Exactly. Well, that's, you know, real rugged stuff there. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the case that we were going to discuss occurred in the wintertime and had a lot to do with the winter environment in and around Yellowstone. So I thought I'd mention the winters that I spent there.
And why that's, yeah, super important. And I noticed that in some of the parks that you worked in, like Grand Canyon National Park, you were front country supervisor, is that right?
Yes.
And then in Yellowstone, you did a lot of backcountry.
Not totally, but I would say that I spent 12 years in the backcountry of Yellowstone. So I worked on a lot of resource related cases and, spent a lot of time on the boundaries of the park.
Yeah.
With the hunting seasons going on, you know, in the greater Yellowstone area.
Yeah. Well, cool. All right. So you ready to kick it off? Let's talk about your case.
Yeah, sure. If you just want me to go into it, I would just, I'd maybe first cover a little bit of the history and the purpose, behind, what was going on at the time in this investigation and with this, violation. I would just say that, you know, Yellowstone at the time that the Army was brought in and when the Ranger Division was developed and so on, a lot of that was in reaction to market hunting.
Yes.
And, you know, what was happening at the time is a lot of people were calling on the government to send in some kind of help to stop the market hunting. And what that involved, it was many things, but where it comes to the elk, animals were being killed just for their teeth and for antlers. And,
right.
And with the horn hunting thing that you discussed in another episode, these people weren't waiting for the animals to die and to find carcasses to take the teeth. There was a huge market in ivories, which are the evolved, from evolution, they're actually canine teeth that are used for jewelry and decorations. And they were used by the Native Americans, and then, Europeans picked up on that and took it to a commercial level. So they were actually, not killing the animal for food and then just by chance taking the other things as jewelry and furniture and decoration, but just killing the animals and only taking the teeth.
Yeah.
So hundreds of carcasses spread out all around that, what would be the Gardner area now, Paradise Valley type area, just for their teeth. So there was a big outcry for, protection for that. So moving forward into our day and age, it just so happens that those parts and animal parts are worth a lot of money. and the ivories are still collected and marketed, and the horns and entire bodies, you know, taxidermy, fully mounted bodies of different animals, the heads on the wall, bearskin rugs, every skin rugs, and a lot of it used to decorate the big trophy Western homes that are going up around the area, and the people don't necessarily hunt. But they have, they may have $5,000 to spend on an elk head to put over the fireplace, or $20,000 to $50,000 for a mountain lion, you know, things along those lines. So knowing that that was an industry and that people were profiting off of the park where everything is protected, that was a concern in the collection of parts. As I think you discussed before, it's not just a visitor in the park who happens to see a pine cone or an elk antler or a deer antler and picks it up because it's cool, and they're just clueless to you know, the effects. This is more people who know exactly what they're doing and what the values are and have networks to deliver this. And then another aspect that where money is involved is the commercial outfitting business, where people pay $10,000 to $50,000 for a hunting trip.
It's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure
on the outfitter.
And I always empathize, you know, with that. And also, it was on my mind with weather patterns and what was going on with a given hunting season in a given area, whether a camp was getting their elk or not. Is that every day you would actually feel that pressure as a ranger? You would feel the same pressure that they were feeling. Like they're going to start getting crossing that line. And so now I need to be out there because something is going to happen. And maybe me just being out there will prevent them from crossing the line and getting themselves in trouble or affecting the park. So a lot of aspects to being out on those patrols.
I mean, a lot of times the rangers, the backcountry staff, and depending on where they are, the front country ranger types do try to increase their patrols in those areas for deterrence, hopefully, not necessarily just to catch people, but maybe to deter people who were going to encroach within the park boundaries and take either the antlers or poach a whole animal.
And along with that pressure, there's also a lot of competition in that business. So particular outfitters and guides have to be able to promote themselves. And these days it's on the internet, and around that time that was emerging, but a lot of it is also done at gun shows and sporting shows and, you know, through the sporting goods venues and so on. So, and that kind of leads into some of where, why this was happening, this case happened. And then just the general trophy hunting. It's interesting to me in the hunting world. I've always been a hunter, but I've actually not been that avid about what kind of antlers were on the animal.
Because you want the meat.
I'm not looking for the trophy. I'm just looking for the food. And then, and also just relating it to Yellowstone, you know, the park really serves as a, like a game sanctuary, and the, those bull elk are the genetics of a herd that is hunted over, you know, 10 million acres or so in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So, and that, that comes to when you get into trophy hunting and people are actually going in the park and they're taking out this breeding stock, they're actually hurting the hunting community and the population in general, because you will see the decreases in the trophies and the population numbers. If someone kills a bull elk, which in its prime will breed with 30 or more cows, cow elk, they're eliminating that next year's, you know, productivity. And that has a big effect versus if they're hunting the cows, you know, just for the meat, that's just one calf that isn't going to be born the next year rather than 30. So it's a big effect on the population of both the elk themselves and the hunters. And also these trophy racks on these bulls come from the genetics of that animal. And if that animal is taken away out of the population and isn't breeding, then you lose that. So there's, that many fewer trophy out for everybody else. So there's a, right. there's kind of a fairness issue in the mm-hmm. ethics of poaching.
Yeah, and, exactly.
And, you know, basically going in, to this case, probably everyone who's ever hunted looked at this bull and wished that they could take it, but knew that it was illegal.
Yeah.
So there's an unfairness factor in the person right. who's willing to break the law,
right.
Winning on that. And it's just no secret that Yellowstone is really the breeding ground and the genetics of this whole ecosystem. Mm-hmm, so
right.
that's why we may guard that very exactly. avidly as rangers right. and conservationists.
Right.
So when this case happened, it was really the result of I was working up in the northern northwest part of Yellowstone, where there's a big wintering area for elk. And most of the elk, as far as I understand, a big number of the elk leave the park during the winter
because right.
there's just so much mm-hmm. snow. So there's a huge migration in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we would see hundreds of elk come yeah. down out of the mountains down into this valley, down to the Gallatin River. And there would be these older, very large, very impressive, what they call monarch bull elk.
Yeah.
Who would pick out a patch of vegetation, probably half the size of a football field. And they would keep everything else off of that. And they would stay in that spot for the winter. And you could just wow. see them in that spot every day.
Yeah.
And they would be 50 to 100 yards from the highway and not bothered at all by, sometimes half a dozen or a dozen photographers taking pictures of them
mm-hmm.
on the side of the road.
Yeah.
So it couldn't be more in a national park, than it was.
Right.
This was not out in wild country where the animals are afraid of people and, are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Running for their lives.
Yeah. They stay pretty comfortable in some places.
Yeah. And so this elk was one of those elk and was in one of those places. And really what they're doing is starving their way through the winter.
Yeah.
So, he's not going anywhere. He's not exerting any mm-hmm. Effort. And my observation was that this was an elk that was probably past its breeding prime.
Hmm.
But regardless, when their horns come back the next year, they're impressive.
Right.
Their bodies just might not look as mm-hmm. Vibrant as
right.
when they're younger. Not...
Well, whose does?
Right.
Ditto.
So we can all kind of, some of us can relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of setting the stage of what the real situation there was as far as a challenging hunt or what bragging rights a person might have over,
right.
Conquering this mm-hmm. wild animal. So this part of the highway is within the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park. So the rangers patrol it. And it's a small community there in West Yellowstone. So especially during the winter, we interact a lot with the local public. And what I was hearing some people tell me about was that they would see animals that were hit by vehicles, which a lot of animals get hit on yeah. the highway by semis and just people driving too fast, yes. basically for conditions. And a lot of them get hit during the night, and a lot of them don't get reported,
right?
Because the semis and the drivers don't necessarily want to draw attention to what happened,
right? And the people with no valid driver's license and the people who are DUI, they want to keep going.
Okay, well, you said that. but yeah, definitely the case that people that didn't want law enforcement attention at the time, but we'd also have a lot of those vehicles would have to be towed. So towing operators would tell me the same thing, which was that by the time anyone gets to these animals, their horns would be sawed off, their antlers, or their teeth would be missing, or the whole animal would be gone.
Yeah.
And that thought of just, well, this is actually a pretty remote area in the wintertime. There's really not a lot of, traffic and mm-hmm. attention in this area. It's
yeah.
Mostly a lot of local people. But the thought
And when you say local, we're talking about greater Yellowstone area, local Bozeman, Montana, West Yellowstone, and Idaho.
Yeah.
Traffic, basically.
Yes. And it, really a lot of people who come to visit the area because it's a slow time of year. And they right. can, and in the winter, you can see a lot of wildlife. So I was getting these stories from people, and it just seemed interesting to me that you almost couldn't find a carcass on the, in the area of that highway that still had all of its parts. Well, it just seemed like either somebody was very busy or just everybody was doing this.
Right.
But that has a lot of impact, and it's a lot of violations taking place that when it's just a one-time thing, it might not be a big deal, but when it's mm-hmm. really an epidemic.
Yeah.
And it's also showing that we didn't really have – we weren't making that impression of deterrence on the public.
Yeah.
That there must be either a person who feels they can just do this on a daily basis or multiple people. So this was in December of 2005 that we really started as rangers, started checking animals that we normally wouldn't – if they weren't blocking the road, we wouldn't have really messed with them because yeah. they were – food for the ravens and the eagles and the coyotes and everything else. So
yeah.
we would just move them away from the road so that none of those other animals mm-hmm. were getting involved with yeah. traffic. But if it was 100 yards from the road or 100 feet from the road, we didn't really bother with it.
Right, because they're heavy and hard to move.
Yeah, and there was no real reason to. You know, yeah. And it was an opportunity to see all this other wildlife. Mm-hmm. Just that these carcasses would attract you know, scavengers.
Right.
Which is a really good way to find carcasses is you just look for a big, yeah. a bunch of ravens hopping around and a couple eagles and some coyotes all messing around with each other. So on December 30th of 2005, I was observing just such an event.
Yeah.
And so I saw the ravens and the eagles, and I could see there was a carcass, a large carcass there. And it was in that half a football field where I knew elk, mm-hmm. you know, there tended to be a bull elk there. So I went out, I think it was about 100 yards from the road, if I remember right. And being a trained observer, noticed right away that this carcass had no head. That is not usually the first thing to go when animals start eating on
yes.
the dead right. carcass. So it's usually one of the last things left. So it was gone, and this carcass looked like it was pretty fresh. It hadn't been there for too long. Mm-hmm. It was probably, it had been sub-zero, and it was probably 10 below that day. So a carcass could be there for quite a long time.
Oh, so yeah.
Look fresh. It was fresh frozen.
Mm-hmm.
So very hard to get, you know,
yeah.
just by that, you know, how long has this been here other than that I had been there. I think I'd come back from some days off, so I'd probably been out there 5 days or so before and hadn't seen it. So.
Yeah.
So, yeah, otherwise, other than the head missing, it seemed like a pretty fresh, healthy animal. Did not look like it had starved there. And I also noticed that there were boot tracks going to the animal and then coming back out to the highway.
Ah.
So that was a clue.
Yeah.
So basically, that the head was missing, that there were boot tracks. Okay, there's some human involvement in that, and some human beings took this.
Exactly. Head. And you could sure? probably tell by the where the head was removed, maybe that wasn't.
Sure. So I just started photographing everything as I approached the scene. And what I was seeing in the tracking was that it looked like two people had dragged the head out by holding it by the antlers.
Mm-hmm.
So it basically by how far the tracks were spread apart and where the head, you could see where the head had been dragged through the snow.
Right.
There was about probably 2 feet of snow. So there was a deep trench with two sets of mm-hmm. tracks and there was blood in there in the snow mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
you know, it didn't take Sherlock Holmes to figure out what was going on. So I was seeing it as there is some kind of a violation. At least that violation has taken place. Some human yes. beings took yeah. this head out of right. Yellowstone National Park. Or even just that they moved it from where it was. But
yeah.
pretty sure since the tracks, you know, went all the way to the road that it probably got thrown in the vehicle and,
yeah.
and driven away. So as I got closer, I could see the spine of the neck sticking out
mm-hmm.
and could see where it had been sawed off with a saw.
So
that's, you know, that takes a little bit of planning the whole thing. You know, it's, this isn't something where someone just walking by, you know, or a visitor just saying, "Oh, there's an elk. We should just saw off the head." And
yeah,
drag it
we'll
up
just
to our truck.
Like, get my handy dandy saw that I packed on the airplane. Yeah, I put it in my carry on luggage. Could have been a machete. Right.
Yeah, but so my suspicions just started raising that.
Yeah,
this is probably dealing with somebody who's you know planning and has probably done this more than once. But in investigating wise, I the next thing I wanted to know is whether this how this animal died. So was it hit by a car and then someone scavenged mm-hmm. the head from it, or did somebody kill it and take the head? So my next plan was to skin the hide off of the carcass and look for either bullet wounds, which you can see a lot better once right. the hide is off. And what you can also see is it's pretty obvious the trauma of to the body if it's hit by a vehicle. It's, you know, you'll see the ribs will be destroyed and there'll be all kinds of damage to the, you know, the organs and everything else versus a bullet hole is a bullet hole. And then I also collected the section of the spine that had been cut for matching that to tool marks later on in the investigation. It's a, you know, kept it as a piece of evidence.
Yeah.
And then I actually, I went back to the station to get some more equipment myself, more evidence bags and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I happened to come across a biologist named Craig,
yeah,
who lived in West Yellowstone at the mm-hmm. Ranger Station housing mm-hmm. there. And him and I had done a lot of work with animal carcasses and things like that. So I invited him to come along with me. And we went up and skinned this elk together and found two bullet holes.
Wow.
In the hide. And
where, what part of the elk were the bullet holes?
So the bullet holes were in the neck. And So where they had cut it off, they were able to actually take one of the bullets away.
Oh.
But one of the bullets was still in the body. So one technique that we use with a carcass that gives you a quick idea of whether or not you have the animal's been shot or shot with an arrow or shot with a bullet or anything like that is just running a metal detector over it, which is just your standard store-bought beach comber type thing. And so if you're getting an indication of metal in any animal, then you can, makes it a lot more worth your time to start skinning that animal
right.
and getting more direct to finding that bullet that you're looking for. Because when the bullet goes in, and what we had seen there is we had two entrance wounds and only one exit. So we were pretty sure that there was a bullet inside that body. The odds were pretty high. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure that the metal detector indicated that. And then we just, you know, kept skinning and you know going down that bullet hole to find that evidence, and then it was found.
Well, that's cool.
And then I also took a piece of the hide as evidence to use for DNA, and mm-hmm. then we had the bone marrow out of the spine was also
interesting.
Separated that out for DNA.
Well, rangers aren't messing around. That's quite the evidence collection. You know, similar to how you investigate a homicide or something.
Yeah. And I that's why I mentioned these things. It's not to say, oh, look what I did, but just this is what rangers do.
Yeah.
it's not everybody, but the people who are working these cases as if they're homicides.
Right.
As far as what evidence is collected and, you know, as you'll see further things that we pursued with it. So that hair, bone and bone marrow samples for the DNA were sent to the Wyoming lab, wildlife lab,
mm-hmm.
I believe. They either went to Wyoming or the federal lab. Anyway, they were sent to the lab for DNA analysis so that we would have some DNA information to match to any parts that, like a head that we might find later in the investigation. Yes. And then also the bullet that was recovered from the carcass was sent to the FBI to be analyzed.
Yeah.
And we got a return on that it was a 30 caliber type firearm. So we had at least the type of bullet.
Yeah.
And just a side note on the bullet evidence, if law enforcement has the bullet and can get the weapon that it was fired from, they can fire that weapon and compare the bullets.
Yes.
And firearms make a lot of different markings and indications that are fingerprint-like as far as usefulness mm-hmm. and evidence
yeah.
onto bullets and casings and things like that. So, yeah. yes, we can match evidence found on the scene to firearms in people's right. possession and under use,
yes.
which is, like I said, is like what they do with a homicide.
Yep. And on TV.
And on TV. And only the only difference is the time.
Yeah, exactly.
the time frame, and probably some other right. differences too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had, you know, that and the tracking evidence and the photographs and what we had from the scene up to that point. So the next thing that we did was called the investigative services branch to get them involved. And then also I talked to the public information office mm-hmm. for the park, and we got a press release put out offering a $500 reward for information that would lead to the conviction of this person. Yeah. So that actually, I don't know if it was a slow news day or if this is just the kind of thing that's very interesting to people in Montana.
Yeah.
but that ended up on television news. Within a day or so, and in all the papers. So we had a hotline set up for information, and we started getting multiple calls every day.
Yeah.
Which
for that big hotlines, $500 reward that the National Park Service sprung for.
Yeah. You know, and I really think that there were a lot of the calls that we got who were people who were willing to leave their names, and they were actually just really interested. You know, there was the photographers and yeah. the, you know, just the elk watchers and local people who were really, I guess, offended, for lack of a better yeah. word, nauseated
yeah.
that well, somebody this, did this.
Anger people, for sure.
Yes. Oh, yes. There was some public outrage. Let's put it yeah. that way. So everybody wanted to help. And so we had mostly calls about vehicles that had been in that area, which is what we were looking for. We
yeah.
wanted, you know, some kind of consistency of, oh, I think we know what we're looking for.
Yeah.
For the person returning to the crime or mm-hmm. Whatever they might do. If they didn't know that we were onto them, they may just continue, which I'm quite sure they did.
Yeah.
With what they were doing. And I'll just mention that I found multiple headless elk in the course of investigating this.
Yeah.
I think four other ones in that same
wow.
area. So we just it's needed to tie. Food. Yeah, it was. And that's what I was saying. Like, I would not be surprised if that elk population up in that area wasn't decimated.
Yeah.
By this taking place. I'm sure mm-hmm. that the effects for years down the road were felt. But we always have wolves to blame for that, so we don't have to have to look at every possible
right.
cause
yeah.
of the population.
Yeah.
So we had a green Chevy, a white Ford, a blue Dodge.
Right.
Just about any kind of truck that yeah. you could name, every different color, all that coming in. So we didn't have a lot of consistency out of it, but it was good to see that we had a lot of eyes out looking mm-hmm. and were calling us if yeah. they saw anything
right.
suspicious. And it did actually turn out when we went back, once we discovered our suspect, when we went back to the logs, that their vehicle was actually on there and that we had run the license plate and had their name on our log.
Oh, very good.
Of possible yeah. Vehicles. So
yeah.
it did, you know, we did come across it because as rangers, we were also watching every vehicle up in that area and trying yeah. to look for who was hanging around that might be suspicious and talking to anyone who we could talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And we may or may not had a couple rangers out in a beat up old Subaru wearing their flannel shirts and
yeah, yeah.
baseball caps.
Yeah.
So that to see what people were doing when they didn't, mm-hmm. when there wasn't a ranger around.
Yes. Right.
That's a tactic that's certainly used by all law enforcement agencies
yeah.
and may have been used at that time.
Yeah.
So some of the people who were sending us information were doing photography up in that area, and
yeah.
these big bull elk were positioned and posing themselves for photography that they wouldn't be able to get any other way,
you know,
or at least
yeah.
not as easy. So, you know, people were able to pull up in their vehicles and set up their cameras and take these majestic pictures of this monarch elk.
Yeah.
Which is that part is legal. You're not taking anything from the park, and you can sell those pictures for as much as you can get. So it just so happened, as I explained before, that elk spent the whole winter pretty much in one spot. So these photographers knew that elk. Ironically, they had a nickname for him, which was Lucky.
Oh.
And I think that they thought that he was lucky to have lived so long, and, you know, and that he lived in Yellowstone National Park where he couldn't be hunted, and that, you know, he had the love and admiration of their group.
Yeah.
But the great thing about that is they were able to provide us a photograph of that elk in that spot when it was alive.
Yeah.
And they, you know,
that's said interesting.
They could basically testify that they had seen that elk in that spot for years. So they knew what head belonged on that body and gave us a picture of it.
Wow. Perfect.
So now we never really stopped working on that case, but with any case, they start to get cold and people lose interest and information.
Yeah.
You know, fades away. But it just so happened that there was a game warden in Montana. I think he was a special agent. He was working on an elk case in Montana, and also as his part of his investigative duties, he would go to taxidermy shops on a regular basis. And taxidermy shops are subject, by I think most state laws, they're subject to inspection at any time by game warden. So this game warden was at a taxidermy shop up in, I think it was Whitehall, Montana. And he saw a very interesting trophy bull elk head in there.
Wow.
And it was probably the largest that he'd seen that year. So he was very curious as to who shot it. And he asked the taxidermist who shot this elk. And the taxidermist said, well, I did.
Right.
And the game warden said, well, where did you shoot it? Where were you? And, the taxidermist didn't really remember exactly. And he didn't have a hunting story to tell about shooting.
That's a really big, beautiful elk that I just can't seem to remember where
that particular one I just don't really remember.
Yeah. And they all blend in.
And this game warden, you know, he went out into the parking lot of this taxidermy shop and called Yellowstone National Park and got connected to me. And he said, I'm pretty sure I have your elk head. And this was, I think this may have been a year later.
Wow.
It was quite a while later. And he told me that story. You know, he said, I'm talking to this taxidermist here who says he shot this animal, but he's not spending an hour telling me the story of that morning when he shot this, massive trophy elk. Right. He said, I don't think that he shot it, but he is going to have to tell me who did.
Right.
And so he asked me if I had collected any evidence for DNA that he could match to that head, because he was pretty sure it was the same cape, meaning the same hide. Yeah. And so the same hair and everything on the animal. And so I told him what I had, and that I had sent it into the lab, and I had the information back, and, you know, was ready to match it. And so he basically said, all right, I'm going to go back inside and seize this head from this guy and come down and meet you, and we'll run this DNA and see if we can come up with a match.
Yeah.
So when I went to meet with the game warden from Montana, who had seen the head of that elk in the taxidermy shop, and he came down to get the DNA, I also was able to show him the photograph that we had gotten from the photographers of that elk standing in that spot. And he said, that's the one. It was a very distinctive set of elk antlers. It wasn't, they call it atypical in the hunting world.
Uh-huh.
That it didn't just have very standard six prongs coming off of the antler. It had like a flat section that almost looked like a caribou.
Wow.
And some other kind of anomalies that would make it a big trophy.
Very distinguishable. Know, very
Yes, and it also made it a nice piece of evidence because it was distinguishable.
Yeah.
So we had that, and then the game warden was able to get the name of the person who brought that head in.
Yeah. Wow.
So we had a suspect, and we had a lot of evidence. So we had a case, and we worked with the Investigative Services Branch, which is, I like to say, they're like the detectives of the Park Service law enforcement.
Yeah.
And yeah, other special agents. Yeah, and so they get, you know, they get attached to special cases, and they're able, they don't do patrol, and they don't do their own maintenance.
Yeah.
And all of those things, so that they can focus on these cases. So they were able to get a search warrant for two residences of the suspects. One was his actual home that he owned, and then the other was the cabin that he stayed in on a ranch that was only about 6 miles from this site.
Oh, convenient.
Where he worked as, where he worked as a hunting guide. He operated out of that place. So as this was developing and he was being interviewed, we were finding out more about him, and just checking his criminal history, found out that he was a convicted felon for having done some bar fighting. And apparently he was the winner because he was the suspect.
Caused some serious bodily injury on someone, I suppose.
I believe so. And, you know, that's, you know, people make mistakes and they end up in, you know, in that kind of situation. Right. But how it pertained to this case was that he was prohibited from even handling firearms.
Yeah.
So it became a big part of the case, or, you know, we had not only that he may have killed this elk, but if he did shoot this elk, he was also in violation of a federal firearms charge for that possession. So he had a lot to lose. And that, you know, made the case just that much more interesting in terms of making it happen. And it's another fast forward, because it's not, you know, CSI.
Yeah.
Miami.
Yes.
It took some time. So it may have been almost another year that we got our match.
Wow.
So we were able to match, you know, the DNA from what I had collected to the head that he had collected. And now we had a case.
Yeah.
So at the time that the warrants were executed, the suspect was also interviewed by the special agents and admitted to killing that elk.
Yeah.
And his, I think that it's interesting the reasons why he did it, because it's kind of the sad part of the story in a way, is that the only reason that he wanted that elk head was to display, to promote his hunting business.
Just bragging rights?
Well, you know, he would go to gun shows, and my understanding is he would go to these, you know, sporting shows and gun shows and, you know, set up a booth, and that, you know, or that there were people that were doing that, and this is how he wanted to use it, was, you know, how promotable is your hunting business when you have this massive trophy, you know, sitting behind you in your booth. And he also admitted to having videotaped this scene when they were collecting the head and several others that they basically, him and his friends, role played that they had just legally shot this animal, and how excited they were about this hunt, as if they were on a hunt with him as their guide.
We've been hiking for days.
They made a fake commercial out of it.
Wow.
So they could use it for advertising. So there was a not lengthy, but a, you know, reasonably attended legal battle. You know, he did have a lawyer, and basically they were just negotiating the terms of what kind of a plea deal he would make in terms of pleading guilty to lessen the consequences.
So, in looking at the press release regarding this case, after it was over, so the suspect was Michael Beldrain, and what were his charges, or what was the result of this investigation?
So he was facing the possession of firearms by a felon, a prohibited possessor, and then also the game violations,
which are felonies.
Yeah. So basically he had a Lacey Act violation, which is, you know, transporting, you know, whole list of basically everything that he did is on the list of
the Lacey Act.
This being a crime.
Yeah.
And then he was, you know, had the issue with the possession of the firearm. And there were a lot of things mentioned that I don't think that he was charged with. You know, once you have a poaching case, you have, I believe, yeah, it was still illegal to even possess a loaded firearm in Yellowstone at that time. So just the fact that he had the gun in Yellowstone was a charge. Then the use of a firearm is a charge.
Yeah.
And then just the collecting of the parts. So he had just found that head on the side of the road and taken it. That's a crime in and of itself.
Exactly. Yeah.
So all of these things, they could stack all these things together, but generally they'll plead them out or they'll,
right,
you know, just narrow it down to the most serious offenses. Yeah. So that's what they were doing. He ended up with 48 months in federal prison, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Yeah.
48 months for the possession of the firearm, and also 12 months for the game violation. And that was served concurrent. So he was just doing the 48 months. But 12 months of that was attached to the game violation. He had $6,000 in restitution.
Ah.
Which is basically to pay for having killed the animal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that number is usually related to the cost of hunting that animal. It's kind of the best way they've come up with how to say what is an elk worth, what is a bear worth.
Yeah.
On the market. So a person could easily make $6,000 guiding that hunt to get that elk outside of the park. And then he got $1,000 fine for the crime.
Well, let me just say as an aside that $1,000 fine he got, technically it's a criminal fine, and it goes into the crime victims fund for victims of crime. As a matter of fact, it didn't go to Yellowstone. Yes. It goes to the crime victims fund. Yeah.
And then $150, what is it called? The service fee? Court cost?
Oh, yeah. Processing fee or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So it ended up taking, you know, $7,150 out of his pocket, which is probably enough to, you know, some people don't feel any pain with that amount of money. But also when you're getting carted off to jail for 4 years.
Yes.
Money, you know, cash has a lot of value for people back home.
You're not able to earn money while you're in jail.
Right. And, you know, I guess, you know, his side of the story is his side of the story. But I do know that, I mean, I'll just say that I've always felt a little heart-wrenched every time I put somebody in jail.
Yes.
To be honest. I feel bad for the person that they have to go to jail, but I don't feel sorry for them considering whatever they did.
Right. Yeah.
I don't feel bad that I'm doing it, but you have to empathize a little bit with a person who has a family at home, has a job, has a house. You know, they're doing a lot of things right. And then they did some things wrong, and now they're paying a high price for it.
Yeah.
And I probably felt more empathetic towards his family than him.
Yeah.
Because now his
wife
with several kids now has to deal with all this on her own because he wanted to go shoot an elk.
You're right.
For his own, you know, ego, pride, and
you
know, small amount of money.
Yeah.
There was probably some domestic, you know, sadness over.
Yeah.
Over that. And so it's just, you know, it's just never good.
No. No.
But, you know, we were doing our job, and the importance of the integrity of, you know, the park boundary and, you know, the ecosystem, the elk population, the hunting community, the wildlife loving community, like all of those things are just a lot more important, I guess I would say, take priority over someone who's making the choice to screw up their life.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
So it falls on them. So given the charges that he faced and that he actually did time in prison and that this cost a fair amount of money that most people don't have to give up, and just there was a lot of public information out from the original press release that we put out to follow up in the news. It was a pretty big story. I think that it's still ongoing as a story, and we're still talking about it.
We're still, exactly.
That's really important that people know that this happened. And I feel like that it's important that they know that as rangers, we know what we're doing and we can catch
exactly.
you.
Right.
that there's consequences to these actions, and that these laws, they have meaning in terms of being able to manage the park and preserve what we preserve. But they also have teeth in the, the sense that you could basically ruin your life.
Yes.
Or you can bring yourself into a lot of hardship and make people think twice about whether is this shooting this animal or taking this thing, collecting these horns, doing whatever you can do. Is it really worth it?
Is it worth it? I'm afraid for some people, they cannot help it, and it is. But I do want to add to that. Yes, the rangers, you know, will catch you, and the rangers are the guardians of Yellowstone, for example, the guardians of the National Park Service. But it's interesting to me, as you just said, with the press release and the photographers and the rest of the community who all came together to help bring this person actually to justice in the end. I mean, they are also the guardians of Yellowstone. And I just want to make sure that they get some little bit of recognition to them. There are a lot of people who love our national parks, and they don't want to see resource crimes, crimes against people. And they are also guardians of the park.
Yes. And it was very rewarding. As much as it was disheartening to hear all of the, you know, the collection and the carnage and everything that was going on in that area, there was a lot of retribution for that when the general public stepped in and showed how much they actually care and how many good people are out there that see that kind of a crime as a crime against all of them.
Exactly.
And, you know, see the big picture of things and were willing to step forward and, and contribute. It was, it was very rewarding on that side of it.
All right. Well, I guess that's our case for today. So thanks very much, Ranger Dan, for joining us and telling us the story. Really appreciate that.
That was my pleasure. It was fun. I hope it was interesting for people to hear.
Well, I hope you come back, and I know you have another story or two to tell, or maybe you'll join me with telling a story soon. And so stay safe, everybody, in wild places, and watch out for the company you keep.